Hello and welcome to All Villa, No Filler, a podcast all about Aston Villa, the world's greatest football team. And haven't we genuinely looked like it this week after a series of huge victories? And we got another one on Sunday with a 3-1 win over Bournemouth. Joining me this week to discuss that is a very special guest indeed. One of the top football broadcasters around. One of my favourite people to have on this podcast. You'll see him on the likes of Sky and ESPN. It is Sam Tye. Sam, welcome back to All Villa No Filler.
Thank you, mate. You could be a ring announcer, couldn't you?
I have thought about that, whether to approach WWE wrestling and be like the guy who announces all of the wrestlers coming down to the ring, or you know, boxing or something. Michael Buffer, are you ready to rumble? Move him out of a job and I'll step in.
Would you rather be that or one of the girls that holds up the round cards?
Either one, I'd take it. Probably better pay than what I do in life.
You genuinely gave that a second of thought.
I know, yeah. Either one's better pay than what I do at the moment, I bet. So, maybe. I'd take it. But look, if I was paid to be either one of them walking around a ring holding up a sign saying, Unai Emery for president or whatever, I would do it, because what we've witnessed at Villa in the last week and a half has been absolutely extraordinary. Perhaps one of the best... it is one of the best weeks I've ever seen as a Villa fan. But today, with the victory over Bournemouth, the 3-1, what did you think of the win?
So accomplished. And yeah. It's knocked me by surprise once again. I need to learn my lesson at some point, Frankie. I need to stop doubting this team. Because over and over again, all through the campaign, they have shown us that no matter how bleak it may look on paper, it's never the case on the pitch. They just find these reserves of energy and these spurts and these moments, and it's incredible to watch. And that actually today wasn't really about moments. Like, it was actually just a really super composed and calm team performance in the face of what I thought was going to be a really difficult press to play against. You know, you and I did speak about it before the game, a little bit on Twitter, a little bit on WhatsApp. Like, I think I had the memory of that first game in my head where Bournemouth really genuinely outmanned Villa in midfield. The physical element to Bournemouth's team play and the pressing element caused Villa a lot of problems. And Villa sort of got away with it on that day. They scooped up a goal in the last minute through Ollie Watkins and escaped with a point. And it was not particularly deserved, to be quite honest with you. So I think I still had that in the back of my head. I've been watching these games against Lille. Lille have looked so energetic,
yeah,
compared to Villa. Even in the first leg at home, Villa probably were the better side, but Lille deserved at least a goal, probably more. And then that second game with all that rest that they had, I just looked at all of the clues. I just thought, today's going to be a really tough one. I do not know what these players have got left. Then you add in the fact that, like, Emi Martinez is like, the players are drained. We need you. You know, the club are calling for people to get to the stadium nice and early. John McGinn doing an interview saying that they didn't even expect Leon Bailey to be in France because he's so injured. I thought Villa were going to look really leggy. And I apart from Matty Cash, who to be fair, like, anyone in the world would feel leggy if you were Matty Cash. He didn't really suffer that much.
Really surprising, wasn't it?
Amazing.
I was exactly like you. I was expecting Bournemouth to really make it hard for us with their press. And I think there was a period in the first half after the first 10 minutes where they started to do it a bit, leading up to when they got their goal. And I sort of feared they might get a second soon after it as well. But
They pressed Villa's right-sided build-up really well in the first sort of 20 minutes. Cash was really struggling with that. And he does, irrespective of the penalty, even before that, like, he does sometimes, when you can trap him up against the side, he does look a bit uncomfortable. Yeah. And Konsa, who's not the greatest on the ball anyway, as centre-backs go, often actually looks a little bit better than Cash.
Yeah.
At right back when pressed up against the sideline. And you saw after sort of 20, 25 minutes, Leon Bailey was dropping really, really far back.
He was.
To take the ball off Konsa instead of Cash.
Yeah.
And then he was like sort of dancing around and doing like drag backs and turns and winning throw-ins and winning fouls. And I think Bailey really sensed that Cash was struggling and he dropped in to try and help him, which was really nice to see. But obviously it pulls Bailey all the way down that one flank, and you've got Konsa, Cash and Bailey all stood within sort of 15 yards of each other, and the ball's kind of going nowhere.
Mm.
And that's it. The press is working. You've trapped the team. All you need to know is nick it off their foot and you're 25 yards away from goal. And it was starting to look a bit hairy. It really was.
Yeah.
And that was even before Cash then dives in and gives away the penalty, which was like no one in the world would even have it in them to suggest that that wasn't a penalty.
Yeah.
My reaction was, oh, for Christ's sake, Cash.
Yeah, like that.
And I think everyone just went.
Yeah, it was one of them.
Stonewall, absolute stone. You can't even argue your way out of that one. No chance. Not with a straight face.
And I think it's true. I mean, like, you know, Matty Cash, he was missing for 3 weeks. And I think, at the Premier League level, even just 3 weeks, it's really difficult to just suddenly come straight back into it. And like he had to do against Lille. And I think in the first half against Lille, there were a couple of moments he got caught and looked a little off the pace. But weirdly, if you watch the highlights back of Lille Aston Villa on Thursday night, all of our chances seem to be Matty Cash.
All the shots are Matty Cash.
I was like, when I've completely forgot about this.
I sent that 10-minute cut. You seen the 10-minute cut from the sideline? I sent that to a friend of mine who doesn't support Villa, actually. And I sent it over and said, if you're bored, watch this, because it's especially the last 2.5 minutes from the Douglas Luiz penalty through is fantastic viewing. Great camera work. Whoever's put that together from the sideline in Lille is very talented. I said, you'll enjoy this. And he goes, I hope there's a bit of Matty Cash in it. I really like him. I said, you're in luck. He took every single one of Aston Villa's shots on the night.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't actually. Bailey took a couple, but it was like everything was Cash.
It was so random.
How is this happening?
Yeah, I'd literally have forgotten until I watched the highlights and I was like, hold on, when did Cash take all our chances and score the goal and take a really composed penalty as well? But I think something I noticed with Bournemouth today, and I think the way we dealt with it was that it felt like at times Bournemouth, when they were pressing us, went into a sort of a 4-2-4. And oh, I love the cat, by the way. There's a cat in the background for our listeners. I love cats, so I'm a big fan of this beautiful ragdoll. who's definitely an Aston Villa fan itself. But inspired by Emi Martinez, the cat in goal. But it was kind of like Bournemouth were like a sort of a bit of a 4-2-4, and it felt like Villa were not afraid at all to just bypass the entire midfield and go long.
Yeah.
And rely on Watkins and Rodgers' kind of physicality to win the ball, hold it up. And it felt like, particularly by the second half, that was just paying off over and over again.
Yeah, so Watkins was dropping into some really different positions to what we've become accustomed to.
Yeah.
So what we always reference this year, whenever anyone asks me about like what's changed for Watkins, I always sort of refer them back to what Watkins has been saying about, well, Emery told me to stop wasting my energy moving too wide, running the channels too much, sprinting off to lost causes, moving over to the touchline. He's tried to stay as that sort of central focal point a lot of the time.
Mm.
Today was a throwback because today he actually did all the stuff that he's basically abandoned.
Yeah.
And I get the impression that Emery told him, Ollie, they're going to run at us. They're going to press with a 4 or a 5. We may struggle to play through the press. They're going to man mark the centre mids, and they have very, very energetic centre mids. And if Yuri and John McGinn are going to struggle to play and turn out from that, particularly if it's like Ryan Christie's a hell of a player.
He is.
He's thoroughly underrated, I'd imagine, across the wider scope. But if they're going to start pinning themselves to the two pivots, we need to just chip over it. We need to go over it. And so you need to get away from their centre backs in order to find the ball. And he was popping up at all sorts of places. And Zabani and Senesi, they were like, do we follow him? Do we not?
Yeah,
and the huge spaces, you know, just either side of the central midfielders. He just kind of picked it up. I'll take that and I'll run off with it. And Rodgers did the same. And that's, you know, Rodgers is basically fulfilling the role that Jacob Ramsey fulfilled.
Yeah.
Which is turn and go, hold the pressure off and go in the half space. And you can just take it 40 yards. And like when Villa beat Newcastle 3-0 at home last season, it was a tremendous display of press baiting.
Hmm.
And then playing through Ramsey and Ramsey turning his man and going and just transitioning into attack. And without Ramsey, obviously this season, that's been really challenging for Villa to do that. And they've played Newcastle twice without him and lost pretty heavily overall.
Yeah.
And like a player like Ramsey in those scenarios is really important. Bournemouth and Newcastle man mark and press in central midfield very similarly. And now finally you've got that Ramsey presence in there and it's Morgan Rodgers.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, swatting players off him like that as he just tears forward 30, 40 yards with the ball.
Yeah.
Straight through the press, see you later, on the attack. It's a really important characteristic. And actually, after the game, Emery said, let's see if I've got it in my, it's probably on my notifications, but Emery was talking about Morgan Rodgers, and he said his adaptation was easier because his qualities fit into our structure. He understands how we want to create and build in our system. So he fits into the structure because he literally has just been like, right, you're now Jacob Ramsey. Mm. He might as well wear a shirt.
Wear a mask as Jacob Ramsey, pretty much. Yeah.
But it's
yeah.
just like, that's it. It is that simple. He's been brought on to do that exact thing that Villa have been missing without Ramsey, and he's doing it.
And he really showed it, you know, in the second goal, particularly when he came deeper to take that pass from Pau Torres. Turned, he found that space, turned, and that pass he pulled off for Ollie Watkins. My goodness. And I think that was the thing with Rodgers today. It felt like every time he got the ball, I thought, I think he's going to have the right touch. I think he's going to have the right movement. And I watched him against Wolves a couple of weeks ago, and I thought that was his most positive display for Villa up until that point. But it was also the one where I thought, all right, there's a couple of occasions you've beaten two men, just lay it off, lay it off now, blah, blah. And I think that's obviously a part of his game that he will improve over the next year under Emery's coaching. But today, there were moments where I thought, bloody hell, the improvement he's showing so rapidly is just off the scale. And I almost looked at him and I thought, you know, I would not be surprised if you're a bit of an heir to Ollie Watkins, in the sense, like, I wonder if, you know, the way he's able to hold the ball up and hold off players and turn, and he's so physical, like he's a big guy, his skill set, he's very skillful. I think Ramsey's a bit more direct. I think Rodgers is maybe a bit more skillful. And then his relationship with Bailey as well, the weight of pass that those two were having was really, really nice. And I just wondered if Rodgers looks a bit like somebody who maybe in 2 years' time might actually be somebody who starts moving further up for upfield and becomes a striker.
Yeah, I can see that. I think mostly just to start with, as you say, the physical build is there. So like, to be that kind of player and that kind of forward, you need to have the build, and he's got it.
Yeah.
And so that's like 50% of the equation straight away. Mm. And then there's like a lot of finessing that needs to happen to his game for that to really come off. But like, if you picture like a striker like Mateus Cunha and like how he plays as a striker, Morgan Rodgers is like in that same, that if you imagined Morgan Rodgers as a forward, you would see him as someone like Cunha. Someone that can dribble and carry the ball over 30, 40 yards, great physical tendencies, and, you know, can score double figures goals, and is pretty skillful. Cunha's really skillful too. In fact, as I've talked through that comparison, I've decided it's perfect. But like that's the kind of striker that I think Morgan Rodgers could become in 2 years' time, that kind of profile. And Mateus Cunha is a pretty scary player to play against nowadays. I don't like the fact that he plays the Wolves at all. So, in short, I agree with you. In a couple of years, we may see that happen. I don't know exactly what twists and turns are going to take place until that happens, and he's going to have to spend some more time in the Jacob Ramsey role until then.
Yeah,
but we'll see. I am of the opinion that his future lies further forward on the pitch, whereas Ramsey's lies a little deeper.
It does feel like that, and I think, and I mean, look, I mean, I think Rodgers today, I mean, the way he took the first goal, amazing. He was sort of in the Watkins zone when he took it. And the ran at the defence, turned inside, finished it. Second goal, the pass he made was fantastic. His relationship with Bailey was really, really good today as well. And I thought Bailey was fantastic.
I'm surprised Bailey's like, you know, I didn't think he'd play.
I know.
The way John McGinn spoke about him, it sounded like he was hanging on by a thread. And the amount of strapping on his knee in Lille, it's gone down. Today he had less strapping.
Yeah.
So he just had the sleeve over the knee today. Whereas in Lille, it was like his knee looked like a piston.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's a positive. And he didn't look hindered. His movements, he was so smooth and so agile. He was chopping and flicking back and forward and fake to shoot, cut in and out. And I was like, there's no issue here. There's no mobility concerns. He looks like he's at 100%. If he wasn't wearing a knee brace and I hadn't heard John McGinn talking about him, I would never have thought otherwise.
No. And he was electric. Absolutely. He's an absolutely electric player. And he feels like he's entered the Grealish zone to me, where when he gets the ball, the opposition team try to double up. He gets
doubled a lot now, big time.
Yeah. And he creates panic. And he's also one of them players who works harder defensively than I think probably people realize.
Yeah.
And also just his, you know, he's the way he impacts games. When he came on against Arsenal, came on against Lille in midweek, played today. Every single game, the impact he's had has totally shifted the way the momentum goes in the game.
Yeah, the right side is now is so dangerous. So like back to that Lille game, the away game, Bailey turned that game on its head.
He did,
and funnily enough, he actually brought a performance out of Luka Dean as well, because suddenly Luka Dean was sort of chopping. He wanted to go up the line, so they blocked it. So he would chop inside. And so he was basically starting to invert into midfield, and he was looking up and he was trying to find someone. And Bailey was on the other flank going, switch, switch. And Luka Dean started playing these cross-field switches to Bailey.
Right.
And like from the 75th minute onwards, whenever Bailey got onto the pitch in Lille, he completely changed the complexion of the game. Suddenly Lille was sort of turning left and right.
Yeah.
And Villa had never managed to get Lille to turn their heads at any point in that game, and suddenly Bailey is there, bang, give me the ball, and then dribbling, I'm on, takes a couple of shots. He clearly wasn't at 100%, but he completely changed the complexion of that game. He was brilliant. It's a shame he missed the pen, because he didn't deserve to miss that penalty at all.
But it shows his mental strength as well. Like, I'm not sure in the last two seasons, the way Bailey was playing, that he'd have bounced back so quickly from a penalty miss.
No.
As he did today. And I think, you know, his pass for the opening goal to Rodgers was absolutely sensational.
Yeah. And shouts out to Diaby as well for running all the way back, taking the ball. Like, you know, that whole thing was everybody was in the wrong position.
Yeah.
Every single player of both teams was in the wrong position. It was like a transition on a transition on a transition.
Yeah.
And then a counter off that. And I was like, wait, who's where? Diaby's at centre back?
Yeah.
You know, Bailey's in midfield.
Yeah. It's one of them where you need to watch about like 10 times. We're like, what the hell happened there?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, we look at kind of Villa today, though, as well. We talk about Bailey and Rodgers, but Ollie Watkins, I know he didn't get a goal today.
I'm glad he didn't get a goal, because that was the best goalless number nine performance of the Premier League season. Got to be. I mean, I haven't seen them all, but it's got to be. And there's a special place in my heart for that, because I'm a big fan of a striker who can do more than just score goals. As you well know, I hate strikers that only do that. They really annoy me. So the fact that Ollie didn't get that goal at the end when he probably should have, and he was really angry about it, I was delighted. Because for me, it's just, I'll never forget that performance now. But if he'd have scored, I might have been like, oh yeah, one of those great ones. But this one, I'm like, the day he ran the show, but didn't score.
All Villa, No Filler on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Yeah, and that's it. Like, you know, the band Everything But The Girl, it was everything but the goal today for the super Ollie Watkins. And genuinely, like, the way he was... I saw this against Lille as well. Like, I think one of Lille's centre-backs is going to Real Madrid potentially this summer.
Lenny Yoro.
And I watched it at Villa Park, and I thought in my head, I watched the two of them together, and one thing I really noticed was Watkins' physicality.
He's
a big, big guy.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like he's almost like learned how to use it better. And he's much more confident of being like, I actually can bully a defender. And it felt like he bullied him all game, I thought, when I watched him.
Yeah.
And then today, the Bournemouth centre-backs just could not deal with him and those long balls into him. And like the third goal, the way he held it up and turned and the pass into Diaby, brilliant ball back to him, pass across to Bailey. Watkins today, I mean, I say it, you know, I think he's got the top assists in the Premier League now.
Yep, 12.
He could well end up the top scorer in the Premier League as well. He's close to it, one behind Haaland and Cole Palmer. Is Ollie Watkins the player of the season in the Premier League, do you think?
Well, I put that case forward last week, actually. I tried to put it to the test for an article for Who Scored, because obviously Emi Martinez, literally apropos of nothing, the phrase apropos of nothing is perfectly built for this scenario. Emi Martinez was asked a random question after the Arsenal game. He was just like, I think Ollie Watkins should be player of the season.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, Emi, that wasn't the question. Like, it wasn't even bloody close to the question. Mm. And he just was like, well, I'm going to talk about this now.
Yeah.
And then Ollie's obviously sat there, like, stood there next to him smirking away. He's like, oh, it's obviously very nice to hear that, that sort of thing. And I was like, okay, so this is interesting, because so I'm as a member of the FWA, Football Writers Association, I do have a vote for Player of the Year, for the FWA Player of the Year.
Right.
The one that famously gave Mark Noble an award when West Ham finished about 16th. So not that it carries too much credit.
Right.
However, I like to think we've learnt and grown as journalists since then.
I bet he scored a lot of penalties that year.
I want to say that I was not involved in the industry at that time. Okay. I have made that extremely clear.
I will,
I joined in 2016 and I voted for N'Golo Kanté and Jamie Vardy won it. So never mind.
Not a bad shot.
Well, Kanté was the best player.
He was fantastic.
So
he was amazing
right.
That year.
I was right.
You were.
Never mind. Anyway, I've been thinking about it this year, and usually over the years, it's been like, well, clearly it's that guy, or it's between two. It's usually between two. So that was the year it was like Vardy, Kanté, Mahrez, whatever. The following years, it was usually like, okay, well, is it De Bruyne or Salah? Is it De Bruyne or is it Virgil van Dijk? That sort of thing. This year, I was like, oh my God, there are like eight candidates.
Yeah.
Like genuinely like eight candidates. Because Declan Rice and Martin Odegaard have been amazing. Yeah. Bukayo Saka's been amazing. Phil Foden's been amazing. Rodri's been amazing. And then you can move below that, the sort of top three there, and be like, okay, well, who else has had a cracking season? Of course, Watkins is right there, isn't he?
Yeah, it really is.
And the sort of production recently has been stunning. You know, him shooting towards the top of the goal scoring charts, top assists, 19 goals, not a single penalty amongst them. Yeah. It's starting to look like a pretty strong case.
It really is.
And you know, I was on Sky last week and they asked me, Unai Emery managed the season? And so people are starting to ask these questions, and there are people, and these dots are connected. Mm-hmm. And the more people start to talk about Unai Emery as manager of the season, and the more people connect the dots on Villa finishing fourth with 14 players potentially, such wood, and then and potentially winning a European trophy alongside it, the more people will put two and two together and go, oh yeah, Watkins has been brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Yes.
I think for me personally, like, I don't know yet. I'll probably end up writing an article on it, and I'll agonise over it until the end of April, which is when the vote is due. Right now, I have to pick between Ollie Watkins and Martin Odegaard, but
yeah.
I don't know yet. I can't wait to see what happens at the end of the season, because it will be by the end of April, I'll have to put the vote in.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, normally these decisions get made just before the end of the season, but the way the Premier League is this season, it does feel like it literally has to wait to the very end, because, you know, if Arsenal win the Premier League, it's hard to argue.
Yeah, but yeah, you've got to be wary of outcome bias there. You know, I don't like to work backwards from the result. I don't want to be like, well, Arsenal won the league, so I'll pick one of their players. Because, sometimes the answer is still Rodri. You know, regardless of who won the league, you know, that so you've got to be a little bit wary of that. But that is how most people vote anyway, right? That is just kind of how it goes.
Yeah.
What have we got so far? Who to me has been the most consistent, the most dominant difference makers? Watkins and Martin Odegaard for me have been the two. So I've got to pick between. Well, actually, I haven't seen many other people pimping Martin. So you and I might be in a bit of a minority there.
I saw him live for the first time this season and I was absolutely blown away. I thought he's a fantastic player. He really is. And I think Rice as well. Rice is fantastic. But I just think Watkins, the goals and assists and the impact he's having on a team that Aston Villa with, you know, a team that we're not used to. In the past, whenever we've competed for the top four, we've tended to fall away, you know, on the few occasions we've done it. And this year, we've got a player that, you know, we go 3-2 down against Brentford, and he pulls it out of the bag. He saves us. You know, he's just to have the numbers he's had is just absolutely fantastic, and has to be going to the Euros. I mind him having the summer off.
That's the thing. It's like, oh, I really wanted to go, but I really wanted to get some rest.
Yeah,
played so much football.
Sure, maybe do pick Ivan Toney. Actually, just take him. Doesn't matter.
It's going to be the same with Konsa as well. Though, like, if Konsa goes, I'll be so pleased for him, but I'd also be like, don't break.
Yeah.
Please don't break. But let's talk about the table a bit more. You mentioned the top four, Chase, because I've been looking at the table all day. Like, all day.
Yeah.
It's starting to look really good. And I know that, obviously, like, it's 66 points, Tottenham on 60. Tottenham have two games in hand. It's still, you know, if they win their two games, it's just on goal difference. So it's by no means an actual margin. It looks really safe, but it's not.
No, it's not, no.
But you'd rather have the games played and the points in the bag than not.
Yeah.
It's a huge psychological advantage to have already done that and got that. And no one can tell me otherwise. And like Spurs have got this horrible fixture list of, you know, the current top three plus Chelsea. The other two, though, are Sheffield United and Burnley. So it could be like, if you use those two games and said, well, those are the games in hand, that's not how it works. Yeah. But let's just call those the games in hand. Let's call that 6 points. We're back to level.
Yeah.
So there's work to be done yet.
And the goal difference as well could switch, because, you know, they could beat Sheffield, who knows, five, you know.
We're five ahead at the moment, Villa, but as you said, they've got two opportunities there against the worst two teams in the league.
Yeah.
To just absolutely hammer them. And I think their last game of the season is one of those two games.
Sheffield United away, yeah.
So at that point, Sheffield United will be relegated.
Yeah.
And they just lost a game, and Chris Wilder said that the team gave up. And that was to Burnley.
I love Sir Wilder. He just makes me laugh.
There is work to be done yet here. And like, it needs to start next weekend with a win over Chelsea, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It just has to.
Difficult game, Chelsea again. But I think I think we will do it against them, even though that sounds... I still, my inner Villa fan, I still have to be, you know, cautious and all that. But I think back to the FA Cup game, and I do think it was in a period of time. It was the one period of the season where we had a bit of a down period. Their tactics were perfect that night. It was the FA Cup as well, so it feels like they were playing for something. And at the moment, I'm not sure what Chelsea are quite aiming for right now. But we'll see. I mean, they'll certainly want to prove a point against Villa. They will.
But the tables have turned a little bit on this one, because Villa now have a week off, and Chelsea have to play midweek.
Yes.
So like,
it's Arsenal as well.
Yeah, and it's a really, really disgustingly hard game. Mm. Probably the second hardest game you can play.
Yeah.
So that's great for Villa. You know, they can just get a bit of rest finally. They're not the ones that are playing on the short week. Chelsea are the ones that are playing on a short week. They've been playing, you know, one game a week the whole season. Mm-hmm. So they've got knocked out of the cups and the first cup really early and haven't had any Europe. So tables are turned a little bit there. Villa need to use that to their advantage for sure.
Yeah.
And they can put it all out there. And hopefully Nicholas Jackson keeps embarrassing himself.
Poor guy.
One way or another.
I felt for him in that semi-final in the FA.
Me too. I do actually like him. I think he's a good player, but he's not carrying a lot of favour with people at the moment, because the Monday before against Everton, he like ruined everything, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah, with the penalty. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you win 6-0 and the talking point is a penalty squabble? I mean, that's outrageous. He'd be so angry. So yeah, it's a much trickier game than it kind of feels like when you look at the table.
Yeah.
But it's a good opportunity for sure.
100%. And you know, the last two games, Luiz has been suspended in the Premier League, and so we played McGinn and Uri together. I liked it. I think they played well together. What did you think of them?
Uri, like, you know, he's not been my favourite player for a long time. Yeah. You know that. I talked about it all through the summer. I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And he had a really rough first 3 months, I think. It took a while for him to come to the fore. I'm starting to wonder if him not playing for about, you know, 2 months or whatever, and really struggling to get into the team, was the best thing that could have happened to him. Not just physically, because I was worried about the physical toll that his career had taken on him. Actually, over the earlier in the season, I spoke to a sports scientist for an interview with ESPN, and he talked about the mental monotony of football at the top level as well. And he said, we always talk about the injuries, or the fatigue, the physical stuff. What we don't talk about is that not only does it have a physical impact on you, but it has a mental impact on you, because it's so relentless.
Yeah.
And Tielemans, since he was 16, has played every week or every 3 days for like 12 years. And like, some players just crack and they need a little bit of time. And as he was saying this, I was like, okay. And then just Yuri started to work through it and get better and better and better. And I was like, I think I'm seeing it. I think I'm seeing a player like smash his way out of like a bit of a mental monotony prison and just become like almost like level up once again.
Yeah.
Because his work rate these last 3 months has been second to none.
Absolutely.
And like, you cannot say that about his final days at Leicester. Yeah. It's just like, we all watched those games. The work rate was actually quite poor. So I'm loving what I'm seeing from him. Like, and occasionally I get a tweet like, oh, his legs are right, are they? And I'm like, honestly, lads, I'm like the happiest person on earth that I was potentially wrong about that.
And I think you made a very valid point, because if you look at his games and the number he's played since the age of 16, the top level, like there's a lot of players who do fall by the wayside by the 26, 27 bracket who've had a similar background. And I remember we went to see him when we went to the Zrinski game in maybe October. Yeah. And I think that was one of the first games he started in centre midfield. And
it wasn't great.
He really struggled. And it did look a bit like everything he'd said about like the kind of the way he'd been at Leicester and sort of lost a bit of, I don't know, it was he just wasn't in form essentially. It looked like, you know, it looked like he was struggling, but then eventually it was kind of the Alkmaar away game where he had a really big game.
Yeah.
And ever since then, it feels like he's just grown back into confidence. And obviously having Unai Emery as a coach, there's something about Emery and the magic he has to get players believing again and getting them to the absolute maximum of their ability. Like it's really nice to see how Yuri's playing at the moment.
Definitely. There was that he had a really good period where he played really well against AZ Alkmaar away, and then he played really well against Fulham at home.
Yes.
It did two games, which may not have been back to back, but they were very close together, where he was brilliant. And I was like, okay, here we go.
Yeah.
And that's when I got the first few tweets, like, oh, and I was like, hang on. It's been 3 months and he's been rubbish. Now we have to see a bit more of this. But we have, like, we have. Yeah. And he was part of the city dominant team. You know, the team that absolutely hammered Manchester City. He was part of that team. He's been really good. I've been really, really impressed. Look, I thought that the games without Douglas Luiz were going to be a nightmare. They've actually been some of our best performances in months.
Yeah, I think I am starting to wonder whether, if you think of the centre midfield pairings, given the fact Kamara's out, you know, for a long time, you got Tielemans and McGinn, or Luiz and McGinn, or Luiz and Tielemans, and I think I actually prefer it just McGinn being back there as that kind of hustle-bustle physical player and the technical... I mean, McGinn's a really good technical player. And actually today, I thought there were moments he ran into blind alleys and gave the ball away in the second half. But what I think he was doing really well in the first half was finding passes from deep to break the Bournemouth line straight into our forward players. Mm. He's always going to have that ability. That's a really good thing he has. But I don't know. I just think having McGinn there, and I think against Brentford, that Luiz Tielemans pairing got a bit overrun when Brentford came back, and if McGinn had been there, I wonder if maybe it'd been slightly different. He just seems a bit more of a bully.
You just need more muscle and more physicality and tenacity, and just more ability to cover ground than a Luiz Tielemans combo. Like, it's not a good combo.
It's not,
because they're actually incredibly similar.
Yeah.
And they're too similar.
Yeah.
And they're too small. Like, yes. If it was two Rodris, it would be fine, because they're massive, massive, yeah. massive blokes who can win all the headers, cover all the ground, make all the tackles, and do all the other things. Yeah. But they're two small guys. They're technically wonderful, and I'm not saying they don't work hard, because they do. Clearly, they do. But it's about having that snap and that tenacity that McGinn does, and that ability to win a duel and just, you know, stick your ass in it, just bite, see you later, yeah. And they don't have it. And if your midfield is those two, you are going to get overrun by bigger sides, and that's all of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are some matchup issues going on with the midfield at the moment, and you know, there are four games left. Like, it doesn't have to be fixed now, and it's only been caused by Kamara's injury in the first place.
Exactly
to be clear, like, it's not like it was a problem all season, but we just have to kind of ride through it till the end of the season and then figure it out. I would be stunned if in the summer we don't end up seeing someone like a Kamara rotator / backup join, like basically what Dendonka was meant to be.
Yeah.
And what Tim has kind of been, in air quotes, since January. Like, obviously Tim has barely played.
Yeah.
Like, he's the backup, but for Kamara, but he's not. Like, he just doesn't play.
Yeah.
So I don't know who that will be. That's a question for the summer, but I'd imagine that's somewhere the club go.
And, you know, I totally agree in that. But also, you know, given the last week and a half, beating Lille at home, I think Lille look like a Champions League team. So I think they're quality.
They're really, really, really good. I don't know how much of it was just because they had more in the tank.
Yes.
Because the French Federation looked after them a bit better. Yeah. But they're clearly very good.
Really good. And like, a couple of high-quality players, well-coached.
Like, really. In midfield, they were really good in midfield.
Yeah.
Benjamin Andre is really good.
Yeah. Thiago Santos on the right. I really like him.
Bring him. Good. Bring him to Villa Park.
I take
he's
it.
He is really good. Yeah. They're a really good side.
I wouldn't be surprised if we linked with a few Lille players or something. But you know, that big win at home against Lille, then the incredible Arsenal away win, and then, you know, the drama of the Lille victory on Thursday night, and then this amazing victory over Bournemouth as well. You know, is this one of the best weeks you think you've ever seen as a follower of this mighty club?
I think it might be for me. It must, yeah, it must be. I can't. I mean, obviously the details are a bit foggy, but back in about 2008, Christmas 2008, Villa were very, very, very good, going really well. Martin Lauzon at the back, going. It was just before Lauzon basically just went. And I'd imagine that string of results that took Villa towards the top of the table was exceptional, because O'Neill just kept finding miracles out of the players. And Ashley Young's winner at Goodison Park was part of a run of form that I would imagine 18-year-old me thought was absolutely amazing. But yeah. I can't remember the specifics because it was a while ago. It's certainly the best run of results or performances that we've seen in the last 5-6 years, for sure, last 8 years. Yeah. There was a run during lockdown where I specifically remember thinking, the only way Villa can lose here is if the referees like mess it up.
Yeah.
And it was around the time that Villa were playing really well and getting results, and then went to West Ham and got done by VAR. Watkins' goal disallowed because he was fouled into an offside position by Ogbonna.
That was it. Oh my God, yes.
Yeah. And it was like literally the only thing that can stop us right now is VAR.
Yeah.
Because we'd just beaten Arsenal 3-0 at the Emirates. I think we went down to 10 against Palace and whacked 4 XG against them. And it was like, oh my God, this team are unreal.
Yeah.
But even that one kind of fell apart a little bit. Obviously, Grealish was at the heart of that. This is a long way of saying, I'm trying to think of runs like it. And I'm not sure. Look, there's been some good stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything better than this. This is incredible.
It's incredible. I think it's just, it's the kind of mental fortitude of this team that I think have, you know, in the past I've seen Villa, you know, my first season supporting Villa 92, 93, we came second. Look, and I've seen us win the Coca-Cola Cup in, you know, 94, 96. But the other times we've come close to, you know, competing was not, you know, under Gregory 98, 99, O'Neill a couple of seasons in the noughts. But we always kind of fell away. It was like Villa just didn't quite have the mental capacity to deal with it. Now it's like they constantly stun me. I mean, playing that emotional game of Thursday night, right into penalties, and then today against Bournemouth, this high pressing, high energy team, and to just be so composed and so capable of just dealing with a high press, and I just sit here and I'm like, I'm in love with this team. Like I want to sit here, look up at the stars at night, and just pick out constellations and pick out the face of Unai Emery and Ollie Watkins scoring a goal. It's just absolute magic. It's David Copperfield magic.
I've been sat here for like 2 months now, just waiting, thinking, oh, could drop off now, could fall away, could fall away, because obviously you've seen it happen before. And then, you know, the little wobble about a month ago, you know, the Brentford stuff and, you know, the taxing physical stuff off the Europa League. I was like, is this it? Is this the team falling away? And, you know, come through this period now, you get a week until Chelsea. The opportunity to fall away is rapidly disappearing.
It's right? Diminishing.
Like before I even realised it was kind of gone. I've been sat here wondering, trying to pinpoint when it's going to be. Yeah. And I think it just flew by because 34 games.
Yeah.
It's nearly done.
Yeah. It's like we're standing at the bus stop looking at like, where is it? Come on.
The bus went past 10 minutes ago. It's amazing. I mean, can you fall away in game week 34, or is that just the end of the season? You know,
I did in fantasy football once, and my friend will never let me live it down. I signed Fernando Torres in game week 33, and it cost me the title. And hopefully we will not do something similar. But just a couple of quick questions, just two more. But we have Olympiacos next in the Conference League.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I know they beat West Ham earlier this season. I don't know a great deal about them. I did see them play Fenerbahce the other night. I caught a little bit of it.
Me too.
Anything you know about them at all, really? Or
no, not massively. I'm the same as you. I did look at the team and think, good God, I know that. Like, you know, there's that tweet that's like, dudes can just sit around naming old sports players and have the best time.
Yeah.
And I know that the sort of crown prince of that statement is the Turkish Super League. But Olympiacos here. I mean, I was looking at this team. I was like looking at who's like David Carmo, who like was Porto's record internal Portuguese signing, and then just like didn't play properly, and they just got rid of him. Omar Richards, the left back that Nottingham Forest signed with a broken leg. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
No, yes, from Bayern. Yes, that's right. Vicente Ibora, who used to be coached by Emery at Sevilla.
Right.
Like moves like a fire truck. Gelson Martins used to play for Monaco and Sporting, and it's just the Daniel Pedence from Wolves.
Oh, really? Is that where he is?
Yeah, he's at Olympiacos. Stevan Jovetic, like the most injury-prone man in history.
Super talented as well.
Super talented. And Ayoub El Karbi, who was Morocco's backup striker at the World Cup when they got all the way to the semis. He was end the series backup. It's just such a mad team. It's a strange concoction of players. I don't know what to make of them. I didn't watch the first leg. I watched them in the second leg. So I was pleased that they knocked Fenner out.
I wouldn't fancy Fenerbahce for
two reasons, three reasons. The third reason is the atmosphere at Fenner. I think I'm genuinely terrified of.
Yeah.
And I think Villa have been thrown off course a little bit this season by Legia and by Lille.
Yes.
And I think Fenner is the absolute peak venomous atmosphere, and I would worry about that. Yeah. Second reason is that Fenner have a defender, or two, actually, to be honest with you, who are really good last-ditch 1v1 defenders.
Okay.
They've got Alexander Djiku, who used to play for Strasbourg, and they have Rodrigo Becão, who was just a huge guy. And even in that game, I saw they were putting together some pretty impressive recovery stuff, like the stuff that Ezri Konsa does. I was like, oh, they're good. They're good. I could see Watkins trying to scamper away from them and failing.
Right.
So they're out. Don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
And the other good thing, of course, is that Olympiacos' strikers are all pretty slow.
Okay.
El Karbi is not fast. El Arabi is 36. Jovetic can barely run and is 33. And that's it. Podence is really tricky and really good, but their strikers are not fast. So that high line should be running at like 100%. And even if it doesn't catch the player, like Konsa will get back and do them. So like just little things I'm ticking off in my brain, like, okay, they don't have a dangerous fast forward to get in behind. Right, okay, Villa don't have to face a really good lock-up 1v1 defender like a William Saliba, or maybe like Yoro did in the second leg. He was pretty good there. Mm. I was like, okay, I'm starting to feel quite happy about this matchup.
Mm. Okay.
So I don't know an awful lot about them, but from what I saw against Fenner, I'm like, yeah, I don't see that much of a reason for Villa to be worried about this team. Oh, God, what did I say that?
I did hear Andy Brassel say, you know, European football journalist royalty, say that he just thought Villa would do it, which was, you know, he watches them enough, and I think it's the first game, isn't it, at home. If we can get through it with a good win, no goals conceded, it's going to be a very tough away day. But
yeah, I mean, no Emi Martinez for the first leg. And so I was sort of sat there thinking, oh, we've got to play the first leg at home again. That's really annoying. I want the second leg to be the home leg, like the Ajax game. And then I thought, okay, so Emi's actually not available for the first game. It's probably a good thing that we've got Emi in Greece.
Just in
case.
I'd agree.
If you're going to pick a game for him to miss, it's got to be the home game.
And if I was to pick a fan base where he doesn't taunt them, them or Fenerbahce were probably the two you want to get out alive. But also just a quick last question as well. You know, Villa, bloody hell, we're so close. I can hear that Champions League theme is rising. I'm turning it into my alarm clock, like Erling Haaland is on his phone. How much more do you think we need? I mean, we need, you know, let's win every game, but
sure.
Given the games Tottenham have, given the games Villa have, I mean, how much more do you think we need?
So I think that if Villa win two more games, it's done.
I agree.
I think it's possible that 4 points does it. Genuinely, I think 70 may actually be enough, but that would be possibly cutting it fine. I think if Villa win two of their last four games, it's done.
Yeah.
So just got to find those wins. And no better time than the present. Like, just get it done against Chelsea, and then give yourself that opportunity to maybe go to Brighton and do what Villa basically always do against Brighton, which is win.
Seems to always like, cause them problems, and they're not really playing for much at the moment, I guess. Brighton, they were battered by Arsenal the other week as well. So
I mean, I was just looking at, I look at the Palace away on the last day. I was like, well, Palace have got nothing to play for, transitional phase, I'll probably be fine. They absolutely smacked West Ham around today, didn't they? So I'm suddenly not
Liverpool
that,
last week.
Yeah, I'm suddenly not that keen on that matchup.
new manager, it's starting to click for them. I thought exactly that today when I saw the Palace result and thought, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's clicking here. And I suddenly think that last day of the season, they'll want to go out on an absolute high to be like momentum into next season. And Villa will obviously be some interesting one. But look, I mean, Sam, as always, absolutely amazing to chat to you. A lot of people watch this will obviously already follow you and know where you're about. But for those who don't, where can we find you online?
Yeah, all the social stuff is STI Football. Write for ESPN and work for Sky Sports as a broadcaster and a few other bits here and there. 90 Mins, other stuff. Can't think of any of it at the moment, but there is other stuff as well. it's Sunday night. Give it to me. But I'm sort of everywhere. Anywhere and everywhere.
Fantastic. Well, Sam, honestly, thanks so much for coming on. It's been brilliant to chat to you, and up the Mighty Villa.